When neither the Chinese or Tibetan governments paid heed to the communications, troops were sent to drive them out. What was wanted was the recognition of a British protectorate over Sikkim, delimitations of the Tibet-Sikkim frontier and the promotion of Indo-Tibetan trade. In 1890 a treaty was signed with China recognizing the British protectorate over Sikkim and defining the water divide of the Tisch River as the boundary between Sikkim and Tibet. A trade treaty followed, establishing a trademark for India at Yatung. The Tibetans refused to recognize the treaties on the ground that they had not signed them. At Yatung, an unsatisfactory place for a trade mart, the Tibetans built a wall across the narrow valley to prevent Indian and Tibetan traders from meeting. The boundary pillars on the Sikkim-Tibet frontier were destroyed. Lord Curzon, then Viceroy of India, tried to communicate directly with Tibet. His letters to the Dalai Lama were returned unopened. The situation approached a crisis when the British learned that the Dalai Lama had sent an envoy extraordinary to Russia. The envoy extraordinary and his Tibetan suite were received cordially by the Tsar and his ministers. It came about this way. Dorjeef, a Buryat Mongol, was a high lama and, as one of the tutors of the 13th Dalai Lama in his youth, had considerable influence over him. Born in Russian Siberia, Dorjeef was also a subject of the Tsar. He had frequently made trips to Russia to beg funds for his Tibetan 103 monastery. He gave the Dalai Lama the impression not only that the friendship of the great northern power would be worth having, but that more and more of the Tsar's subjects were becoming Buddhists. Even the Tsar himself was interested and likely to be converted. Envoy extraordinary Dorjeef returned with many presents from the Tsar to the Dalai Lama, including some Russian arms and ammunition and a handsomely brocaded set of Russian church robes. To add to British anxiety, lively rumors were circulated that Russia and Tibet had signed a secret agreement. Russia vehemently and officially denied any agreement with or designs on Tibet. All the same, the British decided that the time had come for action. Lord Curzon sent a mission, headed by Colonel Francis, later Sir Francis, Young Osmond with a military escort of 200 men to meet the Chinese Amban and Tibetan officials at Camp Adzong, a small settlement a few miles across the Tibetan frontier from Sikkim, to discuss the whole problem of British-Indian relations with Tibet. Young Osmond, with his staff of experts and his army escort, waited at Camp Adzong from July to November, 1903, without achieving anything. All the Tibetans would say was, "Go back to Sikkim." They refused to negotiate. The British Home Government then sanctioned an advance. About 2,500 British and Indian troops under the command of Brigadier General MacDonald took possession of the Chumbi Valley, and the Young Osmond mission, protected by some of these troops, started for Giants. Yatung was passed without trouble, and Fari, also, with troop reinforcements from MacDonald. They crossed the Tanglao on Enbitta, piercing January weather and set up their tents on the other side of the pass at the little village of Tuna, 15,000 feet above sea level. For 2 months Young Osmond tried again to negotiate, but the Tibetans refused to budge an inch and the monks 104 with them were hostile and threatening. Toward the end of March, MacDonald moved up with about 7 companies, 2 10-pound guns and 1 7-pounder. Young Osmond announced to the Tibetans that he would move on to Giants on March 31 and warned them against obstructing the advance. As the expedition marched across the plain they sighted the Tibetans behind a series of breastworks on a ridge near Guru. Young Osmond held one more futile parley with the Tibetans. If in 15 minutes they did not leave their positions blocking the line of advance, Young Osmond told them, they would be removed by force. General MacDonald had only 100 Englishmen and 1,200 Indians, but they obeyed his command not to fire as they advanced up the hill against the fortified position of a Tibetan army of several thousand. Apparently the Tibetan troops did not want to fire either. The British Indian forces crept around the flanks and were actually persuading the Tibetan soldiers to move away peacefully. Suddenly the Tibetan general, who was in the midst of the Indian sepoys, drew his revolver and shot a sepoy. This was the signal for battle. The Tibetan general was immediately killed. Later it was said that the general was egged on by a fanatical lama from Lhasa. MacDonald's troops had the best position and the best guns. But the Tibetans fought bravely with their old flintlocks and knives. After the action, MacDonald's medical staff took care of the wounded Tibetans, but many had been killed. As young Usmund said, it was a terrible and ghastly business. The young Usmund expedition marched on to Giants. Young Usmund once more tried to negotiate with the Tibetans, and again all efforts to come to any terms were hopeless. There was more fighting at Giants, and MacDonald, with stronger reinforcements, had to storm the Great Dzong, or fort, a formidable but successful operation. It was now a year since young Usmund had arrived at 105, Camp at Dzong. There was to be no more waiting. The young Usmund expedition, supported by troops, set out for Lhasa, arriving on August 3, 1904. The Dalai Lama had fled to Urga, home of the third most important living god, and had appointed as regent and left his seals of office with the Tirumpok, a highly respected old lama who was the chief doctor of divinity and metaphysics of Tibet. With the assistance of the Chinese resident, the Nepalese representative and the Tongsa Penlop, later Maharaja of Bhutan, a treaty was signed between Great Britain and Tibet on September 7, 1904. Young Usmund, with an eye to restoring British prestige in Tibet, insisted that it should be signed in the Pukla. With Tibetans, Chinese, Bhutanese, British and Indian officers lining the Great Audience Chamber and the Regent, the Chinese resident and young Usmund seated at the latter's camp table, covered with the Viceroy of India's flag, and the five copies of the treaty brought in on a large silver tray. The ceremony of signing and affixing seals was a colorful and impressive occasion. In signing this treaty, Tibet agreed, among other things, to recognize the frontier between Sikkim and Tibet, as specified in the earlier treaty with China, to open trade marts to which British and Tibetan subjects were to have free access at Yatung, Giants and Gartok in western Tibet, to pay an indemnity for the attacks on the British mission and the expenses incurred in the dispatch of armed troops to Lhasa, and accept British occupation of the Chumbi Valley as security for the payment. Especially important was the provision that without the consent of the British government no portion of Tibetan territory should be ceded or otherwise given for occupation to any foreign power. No foreign power should be permitted to intervene in Tibetan affairs. No representative of any foreign power should be admitted to Tibet. Considering the indemnity terms too hard on Tibet, the British reduced them 106, drastically and remained only 3 years in the Chumbi Valley. Nor did they stay in Lhasa. Young Usmund was congratulated by the Viceroy, knighted by the British King Emperor and grilled in the House of Commons for what was labelled a massacre. Over the years he wrote many books on the East, dying in 1942 at the age of 79. The Chinese government, disturbed by the treaty, were anxious to restore their weakened power in Tibet. In 1906 they arranged a new treaty in Peiping with Great Britain, by which the latter agreed that Tibet's integrity should rest with China and that China and no other power should have the right to concessions in Tibet. This, in effect, delivered Tibet into the power of China, and China was not slow to take advantage of its opportunity. The British position was weakened and the treaty signed with Tibet in 1904 was little heeded. After humiliating experiences in Peiping, the Dalai Lama returned to Lhasa at the end of 1909. The Chinese had seized much of eastern Tibet, desecrating monasteries and massacring Tibetans. On February 12, 1910, Chinese troops arrived in Lhasa, firing on the people. The following night the Dalai Lama fled with his ministers and a handful of soldiers, making a double-quick journey across the Sikkim frontier and on to Darjeeling. During his stay in India, the Dalai Lama was treated with all the courtesy and honor due to his rank. He never forgot the hospitality accorded him during his 2 years' exile in India. During his stay there he acquired a different idea of the British than he had when he fled from the young Usmund expedition. In fact, he appealed to the British government for assistance against Chinese aggression and would have liked to come under British protection. But that was not in accordance with British policy. The Tibetans, roused to the boiling point against the Chinese, revolted in large numbers and seceded in clear 107, ing them out of central Tibet. The Dalai Lama returned to Tibet in June, 1912. By then the Chinese were concerned with their own internal problems and later fully occupied in the war with Japan. They had scarcely any extra strength to enforce what they considered, and the Tibetans denied, China's former suzerainty over Tibet. They never, however, relinquished their possession of the East Tibetan regions bordering on China's western frontier regions, which have always been historically, geographically and ethnically an integral part of Tibet. As for the British, their position was strengthened after the return of the 13th Dalai Lama to his capital, but they did not interfere in Tibetan internal affairs. They posted their most tactful and friendly officials at the trade marts, many of them men with great knowledge of Tibetan life and customs and with real warmth for the Tibetan people. And Britain's hands-off policy to other powers suited Tibet perfectly. Since India achieved its independence in 1947, the British in India's diplomatic and civil service have been replaced one after the other by Indians. Hugh Richardson, the competent and popular head of the Indian mission in Lhasa, was the last Briton in India's foreign service. This tall, dark-haired Scotsman was most helpful to us. He answered many of our perplexing questions about Tibet. His first contact with that country was 13 years ago when he was appointed British political officer at Gangtok. Through his long, close association with the Dalai Lama's government, Richardson probably knows more about present-day Tibet than any outsider. During the past decade he has spent as much time in Lhasa as he has at his Gangtok headquarters 1 in Sikkim. Prime Minister Nehru's government asked Lord Mountbatten, the last British Viceroy of India, to let them keep at least one Britisher in their service along the northern border. 108. Hugh Richardson, the last Britisher in the Indian Foreign Service, was the representative of the Indian government in Tibet. Here he is surrounded by ladies of the Zarong family, who rank high in Tibet. 109. Richardson, with his valuable knowledge of Tibet, was the logical choice. But Richardson had no intention of remaining permanently behind the Himalayas. In fact, in August 1950, he relinquished his post as political officer and trade agent to Dr. S. Saina of the External Affairs Ministry at Delhi. Hugh Richardson may soon come to America for a tour of lecturing followed by a professorship at one of our leading universities. Much of my life has been devoted to Tibet, says Richardson. It's a glorious country and the Tibetans are a superior people. I'm going to miss them and their wonderful mountains and flowers when I leave. India's present policy, as recently reported, is to interfere in no way with Tibetan affairs or with the relations of Tibet and China. 8. Halfway to Lhasa like young husband, but with an entirely different sea, purpose, we set out from Fari for Giants, about equals, another 100 miles. For several wearisome days our caravan paralleled one of the main stems of the Himajayas. Through the clouds we caught an occasional glimpse of sacred Chomulhari, goddess of the mountains, rising 24,000 feet in all its majesty. Fresh snow had fallen on its rocky ridges and several huge, broken glaciers curled down from its summit. Most of the other peaks, all over 20,000 feet, were hidden, except for the lower ends of countless huge tongues of ice, evidence of the mass of snow and ice above. The Tibetan plateau that we were crossing is dreaded for its high winds that blow in all directions. Even in the summer, when we were traveling, they often reach gale force by afternoon. During the winter the wind and cold sweeping down from the Himalayan peaks are so intense on that 14,000 foot plain that the people are burned black, and they only go out when they must. It is a region of vast silent valleys that look like stretches of Wyoming, Utah and, 111, yak caravans, loaded with wool, pass Mount Chomulhari on their way to India. When used as a pack animal, the yak delights in bolting from the trail into the rocks, usually managing to smash the burden from his back. 112. All plowing in Tibet is done with yaks and wooden plows. In spite of the country's mountainous nature, there is more than enough arable land. The need, in view of the declining population, is for more plow hands. 113, Nevada. If you can imagine those states raised to 3, 4 and 5 times their present altitudes. Almost nothing grows at that height. The lakes we passed seemed silent and unreal. Once in a while we rode by peasants plowing their rocky fields with primitive, iron-tipped shares of wood drawn by the ubiquitous yak. We stopped to take pictures of 6 teams plowing together in one field. When our interpreter asked one farmer why they were plowing zigzag from one corner of the field to the other, he explained that they did it to trap the demon that is in every field. Finally pushing him into a corner, they could then plow him right out of the field, thus ensuring a good crop. At the base of Chomelhari we crossed the 15,000-foot Tangla, second of the high passes on the road to Lhasa. Young husband's expedition came over this pass. The villages looked pretty much alike. All had the familiar thick-walled stone and mud brick buildings, with prayer flags flapping from the rooftops in the stiff wind. Those days of double marches from Fari to Giants were tough ones, 25 and 30 miles at a stretch, sometimes on mules and sometimes on tiny, stiff-legged ponies. We, rather than the steeds, seemed to develop the saddle sores. Oh, our aching bottoms. At the end of the first day we came to the windy town of Tuna, where young husband camped for 2 months. The next day brought us to Kala on the shores of a lake by that name. The third day, to Kangma, and the fourth, to Sagang. The morning we left the little village of Sagang and its dak bungalow pleasantly shaded by willows, we rode through the gorges of the Nyang Chu, another tributary of the Tsangpo, as the Tibetans call the Brahmaputra. Coming out into a wide fertile valley, we caught sight of a distant fort, solitary and forbidding on the summit of a rock rising above the plain. This we knew was the famous Giant Tsong and, clustered below, was Giants, the third city of Tibet, Al 114, tricky going for the horses as Dad leads the way into the Red Idol Gorge near Sagang. Hardly a day of our journey to Lhasa passed without a struggle with mountain streams in floods brought on by the monsoon. 115, though it was still too far away to see. Half a mile before we reached the fort, we crossed the river by a bridge hung with prayer flags that streamed in the breeze. Giants, a focal center for caravans to and from India, Nepal, Bhutan and Ladakh, as well as for internal travel in Tibet, is a lively trading center. The white, flat-roofed houses stretch over a ridge, bending around somewhat in the shape of a crescent. Giants is completely dominated by the Dzong and the large monastery at its foot near the market. Giants's market is rich in color, human interest and activity. The goods are spread out on the ground or on rough tables and the merchants often sit under large umbrellas or awnings, where they enjoy gossiping as much as making sales. Here one finds Chinese brick tea, Tibetan salt and soda, dried fruits, jewelry, dyes, hand-woven Tibetan rugs and poles made of silver birch transported from Bhutan. Wherever one goes in Giants, the Dzong towers formidably over the scene. With its massive walls and commanding position, it must have been invulnerable in the days when Chinese and Tibetans fought each other with medieval weapons. Even young husband's military escort had a tough job to make a breach in the wall with their 10-pound guns and storm the precipitous rock. Looking down through the narrow loopholes of the fort, one can understand how confident the Tibetans felt that their position was impregnable and how easily they expected to overwhelm the small British army below them. That was almost 50 years ago. Today, in the era of atomic bombs, airplanes, tanks and bazookas, the Dzong is only a museum piece. Shortly after our caravan unloaded at the dak bungalow, a messenger came with word that we were about to have a visit from one of the top officials of Giants, a monk in a Jaman's job. This is not uncommon, since many monks combine high positions in religious and temporal affairs. An hour later he came the Rimsi Lobsang Tsiwang. Halfway to Lhasa is the walled town of Giants, third largest community in Tibet and a leading center of commerce. Inside the wall, At the middle of the picture, is the monastery seen from a nearby mountain. Striking figure, Varimshi. In a golden silk gown brocaded with dragons, a tostery golden hat shaped a little like a lampshade, and adorned with elaborate turquoise and gold jewelry, he looked, I imagine, as Genghis or Kublai Khan may have looked. His little fingernail was an inch long, as in the old-time fashion of the upper-class Chinese, and he had a long pigtail, of course. Varimshi presented us with the unfailing white scarfs, and his servants gave us a bag of grain for our animals and a tray piled high with 100 eggs both fresh and ancient. After the usual polite exchange of formalities, we launched into a discussion of Tibetan ideas, too difficult to handle smoothly through the medium of an interpreter, who leaned more to the concrete than the abstract. Varimshi seemed deeply religious, a man of culture and learning in his own Tibetan Buddhist field, and eloquent, too, as I realized from his long, easy flow of Tibetan, which was Greek to me until translated into a few short sentences. Tantalizing because they conveyed only the barest idea of what he was saying. He wanted me to know Tibetan leaders devote nearly all their time to spiritual thought and meditation. But how about the other 4 million everyday Tibetans? I inquired. He pondered over that a few moments and explained with some firmness, all Tibetans concentrate on thoughts of Buddha, Nirvana and their next incarnation. Therefore, any imports from the West ideas, science or inventions are superficial and trivial and have no importance for us. Si Wong, our interpreter, a graduate of one of India's best agricultural colleges, said, Varimshi's comments are too deep for me. We left it at that. During our short stay in Jiantz we visited the large monastery adjoining the market at the foot of the Dzong. In the great prayer hall, dimly lighted, 1,000 monks were chanting their service before a gilded Buddha, 50 feet high, 118 at Jiantz. Another exchange of silk scarves and more ancient eggs as gifts from the Tibetan trade agent, Rimshi Lobsang Tsuang, who wears a gown of golden silk brocaded with dragons, and a golden hat. 119. We drank yak butter tea in an upper room with some of the older monks and walked for a half mile or so around the monastery roofs and balconies. Marveling, we watched a pilgrim prostrate himself before a Buddhist image, rise in attitude of prayer, and fall forward again on his face. He had been keeping up this performance for a week, and intended to continue his routine without interruption for a month every day from dawn to dusk. Two well-known travelers, I recalled, spent some time in Jiantz and wrote vivid accounts of this same monastery. One was William Montgomery McGovern, who went to Lhasa in disguise, and the other, Theos Bernard, officially invited and the third American to visit Lhasa. For many years now Dr. McGovern has been professor of political science at Northwestern University. In his youth he lived in Japan, delved seriously into Mahayana Buddhism and even received an honorary Buddhist ordination from the great Buddhist temple in Kyoto. Brilliant and precocious, he was at 22 on the faculty of London University's School of Oriental Studies. Because of his theoretical knowledge of the Tibetan language and customs, he was invited to join an expedition of 4 specialists setting out for Tibet to make a scientific survey of the country and its people. This was in 1922. The India office in London and the government of India allowed the party to travel to Jiantz, where they could apply to the Tibetan government for permission to proceed to Lhasa and other parts of the interior. They crossed into Tibet over the Nathu Pass and followed the same route we took to Jiantz, only they travelled slowly in order to make observations along the way. David MacDonald, whose mother was a Sikkimese, was the British trade agent at Jiantz then. He hospitably received the group and forwarded their petition to Lhasa. For 2 or 3 weeks they busied themselves in and around Jiantz, ingratiating themselves with local officials and high 120 lamas, while they waited anxiously for favorable word from Lhasa. The word finally came, and it was a decisive no. Thinking there still might be a chance if the party was reduced, 3 of the men returned to India. Captain J. E. Ellum, co-leader of the expedition, and McGovern remained in Jiantz to send another petition to the Lhasa authorities. If not to Lhasa, could they go to Shigatse? If not to Shigatse, could they stay a few months longer in Giants to continue their researches? The answer came back in no uncertain terms. They were to leave Tibet immediately. McGovern was bitterly disappointed. He wanted to attempt the trip by himself at once in secret and in disguise. But he remembered a promise he had given to the British political officer in Gangtok that he would return to India in case of refusal, and decided to return to Darjeeling with Elam. Once back in Darjeeling, he felt that he was free from his spoken promise. And so he began making active steps for a new undertaking, for I was determined that come what might I should make one more attempt to reach the sacred city of the Buddhas, if necessary even by stealth and by disguise. McGovern took a month for his preparations, making a secret visit to Kalimpong to purchase 3 mules and 3 ponies and hiring 4 servants, all Sikkimese, in Darjeeling. The first, a native secretary, was dubbed Satan and well deserved the name from the way he treated McGovern, who had to play the role of servant in Tibet. Leighton, the bearer, who had been with McGovern on the first trip to Giants, joined up again. The others were a sis, or groom to take care of the animals, and a half-witted boy to serve as an odd man. Since it was impossible to depart secretly from Darjeeling, one of the most gossipy towns in the world, McGovern let the word out that he was making a 2 months tour of Sikkim, climbing some of the mountains to do geological work. 121. It was January 10, 1923, when the little party set out from Darjeeling, a terrible time of year to cross the snow-blocked passes. McGovern had to avoid his former route through Sikkim and along the Tibetan trail from the Chumbi Valley to Giants, where he was already known and would be recognized. After all kinds of difficulties, misery and illness, tracking over unfamiliar Sikkim mountains in snow, ice and blizzards, and stopping when they could in dirty, deserted little huts, he and his men finally dropped down into Tibet without discovery and reached the little settlement of Camp Adzong, where young Usmund in 1903 had waited in vain for 5 months to make a treaty with Tibet. Just before crossing the frontier, McGovern put on his disguise. His blonde hair was dyed, stripping to the skin in arbitrarily morning wind. He had Leighton daub his whole body with a special mixture of walnut juice and iodine. McGovern's blue eyes were a genuine problem. He squeezed the juice of a lemon into them. It was painful, but was supposed to give the eyes a darker shade. As an extra precaution, he daubed glue under his lids to imitate the secretions due to snow blindness, and for a final touch he put on dark goggles. He hid his European clothes under a rock and put on one of the 3 Tibetan coolie costumes he had brought with him. This too was the moment for Satan to deck himself out in a fine robe, the kind worn by a Sikkimese noble. From that moment Satan was the master and McGovern was the servant. Nor was McGovern given much chance to forget his subordinate position. North from Camp Adzong, he took a little travelled route considerably west of the more popular road to Giants, which he naturally avoided. The little caravan even went through Shigatse and then turned east for Lhasa on a shortcut used by the postal couriers, but rarely by pilgrims and caravans. McGovern's feet were blistered and bleeding. The coarse food disagreed with him, he had dysentery and the wind bit 122, through his thin coolie garments. He craved unobtainable sugar as an alcoholic craves his bottle and, to top everything, he slipped through thin river ice into equally icy water and injured his hip. He was strongly tempted to abandon the effort to reach Lhasa but, remembering all the trials and tribulations already endured, he grimly set his teeth and went on. From Tibetans he met, he learned that rumors were abroad that one McGovern was probably in Tibet on his way to Lhasa and that local officials had been ordered to keep a sharp lookout for a foreigner. But when he came to the point where the side road joined the main highway leading from Giants to Lhasa, there was no choice. He had to take it. By amazing luck he got through with his companions straight into Lhasa. On February 16, 1923, on the last day of the Tibetan year, just as the 3 weeks of New Year festivities were to begin, Lhasa was more jammed than an American city during a Legion convention, but his faithful Leighton begged a lodging for the night, saying that they were a small party of devout Sikhimese pilgrims. Exhausted, McGovern was dumped in a tiny outroom,